enjoying your lunch. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with the Board of Governors and a convener of the Professional Committee and a Reuters journalist. Before we get going with our event today, just a couple of quick housekeeping notes. If you wouldn't mind, please can you turn your phones to silent or buzz so they don't go off in the middle of our event and Q&A session today. And also, just to update you on a few upcoming events, we're in the middle of a busy season for lunches and other events here at the club. Tomorrow, we have a lunch with Chris Emmett, who has written a book, An Insider's View on the Hong Kong Police and Politics, that was written up in the SCMP last week as well. Also, next week, we have Erin Ramborg speaking about the Bling Dynasty, why the reign of Chinese luxury shoppers have only just begun. And then next Friday, we have Benny Tai coming to speak of Occupy Central. The theme for that talk, take a guess, will Hong Kong ever have genuine democracy? So along with that, we also have a breakfast on Friday if you want to watch the results come in from Scotland. I think that starts at 7 a.m. downstairs in the bar. But now, more importantly, on to the event of today, the English radical who stirred Asia, or should we call it Bowring on Bowring? I did ask Philip what motivated him to write this book, whether it was the fact that it was a distant relative. And actually, he said it came bit by bit. As we all know, Philip has a very long and solid history of reporting around Asia and about Asia, but he kept hearing the name Bowring in his studies and decided to follow it further in the book that is hot off the press. Many of you here know Philip. He is a well-known journalist in the region, also has been a club member since, I think, 1975, and twice president of the FCC, so it's a real honor and pleasure to introduce him. We'll make sure we leave some time for signing books at the end of the event. They are on sale here, and without further ado, Philip Bowring.
Thank you very much, Tara. Thank you all for coming. And I'll thank you even more if I can get through this very quickly so you can then spend your time buying books. You may wonder why I should have bothered to write this book, because clearly there isn't much money to be made out of writing this sort of book unless you're being paid by a university or an institution of one sort or another. So I suppose I have to answer this question, which is actually a little bit difficult, except that it's a process which has taken more than, well, nearly 50 years in a sense, because I'd never even knew that I had this distant relative called Bowring until, well, I suppose I was in my mid-20s, and it was after I'd been at university where I had been asked by my history tutor whether I was related to John Bowring, the Benthamite philosopher. And I said no, because I didn't know. Then I did learn a little bit about him as a result, and his radical opinions and his curious mix of Unitarianism and utilitarianism. But again, it wasn't until I came to Hong Kong that I realized that he'd done other things as well, that he was, had been the governor here. And then I went to Thailand and discovered that he'd negotiated a treaty which was actually very well known in Thailand and a key event in Southeast Asian history, the Bowring Treaty with King Mongkut. And I also discovered that somebody had written a book called King Mongkut and Sir John Bowring, written by a Thai historian, published in Thailand, probably printed about 200 copies at the most, but a fascinating description backed up by all kinds of contemporary documents and letters, exchanges between Mongkut and Bowring, who subsequently became Siam's ambassador to the courts of Europe. So there was a bit of a sort of a transition there. Then not very long after I was in Thailand, I'd been in Vietnam. I was just coming back from Saigon, actually, in April 75, and I happened to be sitting on the airport bus and got chatting to the girl sitting next door, who turned out to be from Indonesia, and she was a Christian from Indonesia. And when I gave her my card, she said, "Oh, are you any relative of the Bowering who wrote hymns?" So I said, "Well, no, not as far as I know." But I said, "Well, I better investigate," you know. And there I learned that he'd written all these hymns, one of which is, several of which I gather are still sung today, and also quoted today. In fact, one of them was quoted by, George Bernard Shaw. Yes, one of them was quoted by George Bernard Shaw. It is now attributed to George Bernard Shaw in many collections of George Bernard Shaw's works. But anyway, it's Bowering's original hymn. But then I looked up what else might he have done, and in the, you know, this was before Google, it was a dictionary of national biography, and there his main claim to fame turned out to be as a polyglot. He spoke, a dozen languages and could understand, a dozen more, ranging from Hungarian through Russian to Swedish to French, German, Dutch, Italian, Portuguese, you name it, he knew it. And there were even little poems written about his ability with language. So this was clearly, a man of many parts. And the more I look at them, more references there were to him in all kinds of different places. But they were all scattered in obscure works on Unitarianism or on Bentham or on the iron industry in South Wales or the Arrow War with China or the treaty with Siam or you name it, he was scattered all over the world, but he didn't seem to be coming together in any one place. So when I began to think, well, maybe this guy deserves a biography. Why isn't there one written already? And I was in puddles about that, and actually remained so until one of the people who reviewed my book before it was published, a writer called John Kay, who's written extensively on India and China and so on, he said, "Oh, it's perfectly, the reason is that biographers hate polymaths. He did too many different things. People who write biographies like, he just did one thing, like Raffles. Raffles only did one thing in his whole life, but it, you can focus on it. Bowering did so many different things, you can't possibly focus on it, and therefore, however interesting it may be in some ways, it's not going to make a book that a publisher will necessarily want or that readers will want to read, because it's scattered all over, he's spread his talents too thin." But I thought, well, yeah, that's true. On the other hand, there's a way of looking at his experiences and saying, right, these are so diverse, and they cover at least half of the world, at a time when Britain was at the height of its global power. I mean, his career lasted between the siege of San Sebastian, when the French were driven out of Spain, to the Franco-Prussian War, which really describes the whole period of British dominance before after the collapse of France and the rise of Germany and then of the United States. So he was absolutely in the middle of all this. He was the creation, in a sense, of an era, of a revolutionary era, because he grew up just after the American Revolution, just after the French Revolution, just after the Industrial Revolution, and so all these things were part of the revolutionary era from which he came and of which he became an important person in promoting ideas of secularism, of free trade, of representative government, and so on and so forth. So anyway, so we, if one puts all these things together, and his family history was also quite interesting because of his, he had many children, and most of whom did some quite interesting things, including one who became a nun, and the first headmistress of the Carnation College here in Hong Kong. But anyway, so I decided, well, maybe I can write this book, and but I wasn't convinced that I could do it until I read this article in an obscure Cambridge historical publication, 2008, which described him as being the leading figure in the globalization of world trade. And I thought, well, that's quite a stunning statement to make. And even if I don't 100% believe it, at least, you know, we have here a theme which overarches all the other things that that he did. So, and it explains why, despite the diversity of these activities and the fact that this book does not actually contain all that much about the trade issues, because the trade issues tended to be, you know, not terribly interesting to write about, even though they were actually very important, became the title of the book, as well as the theme, which I think entitles him to be regarded as somebody of some more of greater importance than has hitherto been acknowledged. Unfortunately, his achievements in many fields have been rather overshadowed, certainly in Hong Kong, by the war with China, the Arrow War, which became, well, after his time, really, Second Anglo-Chinese War, sometimes inaccurately called the Second Opium War. Anyway, I would just sort of summarize now, I think, where he came from and why how he did what he did, and how he came to be such a diversified person. He came from a family of small businessmen in Exeter in southwest England. This was a family which had always been radicals. They were Unitarians. They opposed the aristocracy. They opposed the established church. Unitarians were actually even technically illegal in England until 1812 because they denied the existence of the Trinity. So he grew up in this atmosphere of small business radical types, interested in education and so on. His grandfather had been a great defender of the American Revolution and had been burned in effigy outside Exeter Cathedral for his pains in supporting the Americans. So there was a history here of radical thinking, and but he went into trade, left school at the age of 13, but then became fascinated with learning foreign languages, which he did by chatting to the traders who came to the quayside at Exeter. He also studied languages, wrote his diary in different languages in order to improve his linguistic skills, but also then learned that Exeter was on the decline. This was his first experience, really, of the importance of free trade. Exeter relied on the cloth industry, but the cloth industry was in decline in Exeter because it was migrating to Yorkshire. One reason, of course, was technological change and steam and power and water power. But another reason, which he wrote about, was that the restrictions and the monopolies and so on which existed in the old-fashioned Exeter wool trade made it uneconomic, and it was destined to fail, which indeed it did. So he took himself off to London and joined a firm there in the trading with Spain and elsewhere in the wine and fish and stuff like that. As a result of which, he was sent to Peninsular War during, to the Peninsula during the Peninsular War to supply the British troops with wheat and so on and so forth, and to buy supplies from the locals. As a result of which, he became fascinated with Spain, and then after the war, he was at the siege of San Sebastian, and then set up his own business in Spain and in France, trading various bits and pieces, and became fascinated with Spanish literature. Taught himself all kinds of Spanish dialects, translated Spanish poetry, wrote articles about Spanish poetry for magazines in England, and became involved in all kinds of radical circles. Spain in 1812 had a constitution, a very liberal constitution, which became a highlight of reform movements in throughout Europe at that time, and continued through the period of reaction in Europe, which followed the Napoleonic Wars, with the restoration of the church and restoration of monarchs and so on and so forth. So he became very much involved in all these radical movements, as well as in literary activities. Expanded these to Russia, learned Russian, learned Dutch. Well, I think he knew Dutch already. Then started a literary career by organizing the first translation of Russian poetry into English. Specimens of the Russian Poets, it was called. And this sort of began to set him up in the literary circles. He became he was introduced to Jeremy Bentham, and this is where the Bentham becomes so important to his whole career, because Bentham had no time for poetry, had no time for Unitarianism. On the other hand, Bowring agreed, had all these ideas about free trade, and together they wrote a pamphlet, which was a forerunner of really most free trade documents, urging the abolition of all kinds of restrictions and monopolies. So that established him in new circles of quite important circles. He became Bentham's closest associate and translated a lot of Bentham's writings into other languages and corresponded all over Europe with these people. Then he got involved in the Greek War of Independence, secretary of the London Greek Committee, which was headed by Lord Byron. Lord Byron, of course, went to Greece to help the revolution. Unfortunately, he died. Byron's body was consigned to Bowring in a cask of rum. So Bowring took possession of Byron and a cask of rum. Not quite sure what happened to him. He eventually ended up being buried somewhere, I think, in Leicestershire. But anyway, the Greek thing led to all kinds of scandals because there had been a loan involved and this resulted in him becoming rather unpopular in certain quarters. And then his business went bust because he'd spent too much time on with the Greeks and other issues. So he was really out of a job. He had five children by then, no way of support, except for Bentham. And Bentham then appointed him editor of the Westminster Review, a journal created by Bentham, which was his main voice, certainly the voice of a group known as the Philosophical Radicals, who were stirring up English politics in the period of before the reform movements of 1832. There he is. He's got this minor job as a literary figure, editing Westminster Review, and still writing, doing translations of poetry. But he needed, something more substantial. So he reinvented himself as an expert on public accounts. So next we find him in France discussing French public accounts, and in Holland discussing Dutch public accounts, and writing reports to Parliament on the need to reform public accounts, which led to a parliamentary committee for the reform of public accounts, of which he was a secretary, and which led to a complete revolution in the English public accounting system. Meanwhile, at the same time, because he's sort of now engaged and in official circles, he was recognized as a player, albeit a very radical one, who was loathed by various people, including the Duke of Wellington, who tried to stop him being on the committee for the public accounts. And also pursuing all kinds of other radical ideas, particularly including Catholic emancipation and reform of government in Ireland and so on and so forth. So there he was, a very radical figure, but also sufficiently kind of up to speed with economics and other things that he, in the promoting reform of accounts, and then taken on to promote free trade around Europe, which he could do because he was such a good linguist. He went to France on several occasions in company with ministers of one kind or another, and just went around giving speeches and writing letters and being interviewed by journalists and so on everywhere, promoting ideas of free trade. I say mainly in France, but in Italy. He went to Italy, where he described meeting the Pope. He said, Pope has a poor understanding of trade. So that led to him getting involved in... He went to Prussia, to Berlin in 1830... No, first of all, he went to Ottoman Empire. He went to Egypt, to the Khedive. Spent nearly a year in Egypt negotiating with the Khedive, writing a long book about the state of Egypt and British policy and towards the Ottoman Empire and so on and so forth. Went up the Nile, around Syria, so wrote a 500-page book on the subject. Then back in England, went to Prussia, was there to try and promote the idea of free trade against the idea of the Prussian concepts, which were being promoted by a guy called Friedrich List. Friedrich List is hardly known in English-speaking circles, but is actually an extraordinarily important economist who has inspired various people, particularly in Korea, because he wrote the book about called the National Economy, and it's really about the use of protectionism against to build up your industries, and that's what Prussia was all about. And Bowring was trying to argue against this. At the same time, he was involved in arguing with Marx, because Marx thought that his liberal ideas were leading A, to the oppression of the working class in England, and also to imperialism abroad. So there's a lot of, he was directly involved in these major intellectual as well as practical disputes at that time. As a result of which, actually, he then decided to go back into Parliament, where he'd been briefly in the 1830s, and became Member of Parliament for Bolton, which was a sort of pit of poverty, but also a place of progress in industrial Britain. Supported the Chartists in their revolutionary campaign. And in Parliament, did various things such as promoting end of flogging in the army, demanded the end of capital punishment, very early on to demand the end of capital punishment. A lot of other reform measures, active in the anti-slavery movement and the early movements for in favor of women's participation in politics. At the same time, he became an entrepreneur with an ironworks in South Wales, which developed very rapidly and was praised for the very progressive policies towards its workers. Unfortunately, with the slump of 1848, with overinvestment in ironworks, which was a result of the railway boom, and the railway boom had a bust, temporarily at least, and he lost all his money. The work survived, but he went bust. And so he needed a job, which was how he came to be appointed by Palmerston, with whom he had long had quite good relations, although they were not on the same side politically, who gave him this job in Canton as consul and plenipotentiary of superintendent of China trade. I won't go into the details of his activities in China, because a lot of you may be fairly familiar with them already, but he certainly had a very positive effect on some aspects, particularly, for example, the creation of the Chinese Imperial Customs Service, set up when he was in charge, and encouraging people to learn, administrators to learn Chinese, and which he himself did at a very late age. When he was in Canton, he became quite fluent in Chinese. I went as far as Hong Kong is concerned. His career was not particularly successful. He had many good ideas, most of which were not implemented until after his time, because of opposition from European merchant community, from London, from all kinds of people except the local Chinese, who actually regarded him very highly. And when he left in 1859, he left with their thanks and left with the disdain of the Europeans. There's a lot of history attached to that. There was no time to go into, the Arrow War or the causes and effects of that. But I would just end by mentioning a couple of things. First, I've already talked about Thailand, its treaty with Siam. He wrote a book about the Philippines. It's a very interesting book about the Philippines in 1858, which is still quite valid today in many ways. He continued after he left Hong Kong to be involved in free trade issues in Europe and other radical questions. And, altogether, one could sum him up, I think, simply as somebody who had, through his whole life, pushed for things which, in the end, almost largely happened. Freer trade, representative government, secularism rather than church or so on run groups. These things were his lasting legacy, as well as an internationalism which didn't come easily to the English. And I think if you read what, say, King Mongkut had to say about him, about his liberal attitudes in almost everything, if you read what he has to say about Confucius, he wrote a 5,000-word essay about Confucius, and he was also deeply involved with the Bengali reform movement for reform Hindus. The promotion of the idea of ethics rather than religion, although he was a sort of religious person himself, he was a theist, really, and he believed that ethics and theism was really the only way to go, and that one had to get rid of religions focused on rituals and idols. So I think I'll give you 10 minutes. to ask some questions, and then you can buy some books. I hope this has been. I'm sorry, this has been mainly about his career, other than in Hong Kong and China, but I've been very deliberate about that because those were only 10 years out of a career of 60 years. So think of him for all the things he did in the other 50 years. So thank you.
Philip, thank you very much. We have microphones, so if you'd like to raise your hand, we'll come around if you have a question. Please give us your name and association if you're happy to do so.
Philip, I had the privilege to read the book. I enjoyed it very much. I hope you'll write many more books. I hope a review of it will run in the Asia Week Chinese edition this week. Please, could you address one issue, which is that as you mentioned, in Hong Kong, he was very well-liked by Chinese. Could you say that he regarded Chinese, Russians, Egyptians, all these different people he met in the same way? Did he look at everyone equally, which was would have been most unusual at that time? Thank you.
He had some quite... His views, I think, on... He talked a lot about race, but race really in a sort of a social development context rather than in a genetic or ethnic context. He loved Spain and in everything Spanish, but he was very dismissive of the state of Spain at the time. He was very dismissive of China at the time, but very admiring of the China that he, you know, saw as having been, the China which he's, you know, he saw from his reading of Confucius and so on. As far as race is concerned, I mean, he wrote one of his, back in the 30s, 1830s, he wrote an essay which appeared in one of his minor works called Minor Morals for Young People about the equality of skin. And it's all about the equality of black skin compared with white skin. So, yes, he wrote a lot about, you know, different levels of civilization places, but I don't think he believed in that there were permanent differences. There were merely differences of level at certain points. And I think in the context, he wrote something about Singapore in his book on the Philippines, which sort of goes into that by talking about the different levels of social strata as perceived by, you know, in Singapore at the time. So you had whites, and then you had straight Chinese, and then you had other Chinese, and then you had North Indians, and then you had Tamils. This was actually just a reflection of the reality of the time. And whether you could say that was racist, probably in today's context people would say yes it is, but in the context of the time I would say it certainly wasn't.
Philip, I'm wondering if I can barge in briefly. Sorry, I'm just curious about the Unitarian background. For many people with religions, they left seeds of that or missions, etc. I wonder if he did anything in terms of bringing Unitarianism over to other countries, maybe in a way the Unitarianism drove his more liberal beliefs.
Well, I think Unitarianism, I mean, which was in a sense as close as you could get to secularism, you know, but still be a believer in God. This was, you know, very much with him throughout his life. And, in fact, his second wife sort of revived that. And his second wife went on to become a leading woman suffrage advocate. But that's another story. But I think, you know, Unitarianism was a a force which he saw as uniting people. He could see that, I mean, one of his associates at the time was Ram Mohan Roy, who was a Bengali reformer. Now, Roy regarded himself as a sort of a Hindu Unitarian. He was a Hindu theist. He wanted to, you know, make Hinduism an ethical religion rather than one focused on rituals and gods and so on. And I think that, you know, that's a theme which runs throughout his writing. In fact, if you read his essay on Ram Mohan Roy, then you that comes through very strongly, that this is a principle you can apply in Christianity, in Judaism, in Hinduism, and so on and so forth. You need to get rid of the idols and the and concentrate on the ethics.
Over here.
Simon Twiston Davis. Philip, in the spirit of a magazine story, was he fun? Was he interesting? Did he have many wives, many children, lovers? Was he entertaining? Did he live the life he obviously went around the world having a great deal of experiences. Did it make him a joyful person? Or was he a man who just wrote tracts and very kind?
No, I mean, he was very busy. He had seven children. His first wife died partly as a result of poisoning in Hong Kong. He then quite quickly married again, this much younger woman. He's regarded as actually very charming and easy to get on with, very sort of liberal in his ways. And in fact, that was one of his problems when he was governor of Hong Kong. He simply wasn't tough enough with some of the, you know, sleazy people he had to deal with. That he got where he got from what was a very low status, compared with all the other people around him in literature, in diplomacy, and most of the people in politics at the time were higher-born people, people with landed estates, or at least with money incomes. So he had to survive on his own. Now, it helped that he had all this Unitarian connection, because the Unitarians were a significant, not very big group, but certainly a significant one involved in trade, in business, in development of new academic institutions. For example, University College London, where Bentham's body, of course, is still in situ, stuffed as a result of the Auto Icon essay. Anyway, you can read all about the Auto Icon essay in the book. But he was very pushy. He couldn't have got where he did otherwise, particularly in his younger days. There's some quite amusing anecdotes of how he would sort of sidle up to, I think it was some aristocrat in France, and ask her rather inappropriate questions about her children and so on. But he was sort of liked for his, not bad manners, but for his lack of gentility, I suppose.
I think we have time for one more question.
Thank you. David Lawrence, Associate Member. Thank you very much for that talk. It's achieved its purpose. I'm going to buy your book. One point, really. You mentioned that he was a great supporter of democracy. A mischievous question. What did he do for democracy in Hong Kong?
He proposed that Chinese of a certain level of income should be allowed to vote in Legislative Council elections. This was rejected.
Maybe that's an appropriate note to end it on. One of the true democracy advocates in Hong Kong, and that was many years ago. Philip, thank you very much. As I said earlier, books on sale, and I think you'll be here for a while to sign books. We wish everyone a happy afternoon. But before we finish, a small gift from the club. Great afternoon, everyone.